On Wednesday, May 16th, the city of Vancouver...
Hello, this is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, and this is the summer edition. We haven't had a show in a few weeks.
On Wednesday, May 16th...
Something keeps playing here. I'm Alex DeBoer. This is Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
And I'm Ruben Kwan. It's Thursday, May 24th, 5:05 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunga-Meanam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today on Democracy Watch, we'll be giving you an update on Vancouver's mayoral election. It's 148 days away, roughly, and in that time, we'll be electing a new mayor, city councillors, school board trustees, and park board trustees. The News Collective is going to bring you the lowdown on who's running as of now and what's going down with the city's municipal parties. We'll then turn our attention to a hearing that took place in Vancouver City Hall on Wednesday, May 16th. The News Collective, members Aiden Tong and Sammy Smart were at the City Hall in the flesh, and they put together a report on the newly passed ban on single-use plastics. After that, we're going to conclude the show with an investigation on the YVR jet fuel pipeline, which is set to run through Richmond and supply jet fuel to the Vancouver International Airport. I will let you take it from here, Ruben.
I'm with Zoe, and I guess we can start off with the parties that will be joining us in the mayoral election.
Yeah, so part of what is so interesting, I guess, about the election this year, the main parties, so the NPA and Vision, haven't even finalized their candidates yet. But just based on the independents that we have running, we already have a more crowded field than what we've seen in the last couple of mayoral elections. Mm-hmm. And part of that, I think, is because of what Vision have been doing, Vision Vancouver. So that's the party of Gregor Robertson, the incumbent mayor. And they were a newly formed party back in 2005. So they've been in power the last 10 years, pretty much since they broke off from COVE. And when Robertson announced that he wasn't going to seek re-election this year, they actually said that they would hold off on running a candidate from their party, and they were going to maybe look to find a consensus candidate that other groups from the left could also get behind. So a couple of independents announced their candidacy, including Shauna Sylvester, who's been a longtime Vision supporter, and is a public policy professor from SFU, so kind of overqualified for the job in a lot of ways. But Vision then pretty much turned around and stabbed her in the back by deciding that they will announce their own candidate in the end. So Sylvester, along with Ken Stewart, who would have also sought the Vision candidacy, are now going to be running against whoever Vision decides will be their candidate, which is currently between Ian Campbell and Talib Noor Mohammed, who we can speak a bit more about as well. But I think the biggest news in the election race as of today is that yesterday, Hector Bremner, who's an actual sitting councillor who ran for the NPA last year, announced that he will be seeking the job of mayor independently from his party.
After being dropped. I just wanted to mention that point. I don't know why.
Yeah, quite cruelly. I mean, it's a big surprise that the NPA, so he represented them in the by-election for councillors last year, and he was good enough then to run for the NPA, but he was, blocked by their board from seeking the nomination for the mayoral candidate. And that has caused a huge amount of drama in the board. Four of the board members have now resigned, and a lot of other people who were seeking nominations for those other positions, so school board trustees, park board trustees, have now said that they do not want to represent the NPA either, leading to a lot of speculation that they will run in Bremner's potential new party. Yeah, wow. And we don't know, to clarify, we don't know why the board rejected Bremner, right? Do you guys know?
No, I don't think anything was mentioned specifically. Mm-hmm. They said they will disclose information, but I don't think anything has popped up as far as I know.
Yeah, they've said it was a conflict of interest, yeah. I believe was the official term. And they have
I think this week they sent a confidential letter to Bremner in which they've apparently disclosed their reasons for not wanting him to run. The sort of rumors flying appear to be because Bremner's seen as a candidate who's pretty in the pockets of the real estate industry. Mm-hmm. He's sort of this big, like, pro-development candidate. Sort of his whole take on fixing what's wrong with Vancouver involves developers. And he's had a huge amount of funding from developers in the past.
So is that something that's unusual for the NPA?
Well, I think it's kind of a breaking moment in the NPA. So with him out of the race, having not been green-lighted as a candidate for them, there's three people left who could become the mayoral candidate for the NPA.
Yeah.
So John Cooper and Ken Sim are sort of more within the bounds of what the NPA would traditionally have done. So that's pro-development, yes, to some extent, not as intensely, I suppose, as Bremner himself. And then there's Glenn Shernan, who's running specifically as an anti-development candidate. He's all about protecting Vancouver's neighborhoods and not changing the character of our established neighborhoods. He's pretty much running a sort of scare campaign based on foreign finance being the cause of all the problems in Vancouver. And if he becomes the nominee, then the NPA will have become an anti-development party.
Wow.
And he's sort of their favorite at the moment, largely because I think the other two might split the vote down the middle of the more conservative candidates, unless one of them drops out, which could still happen.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the NPA has sort of labeled itself as being fiscally conservative and socially liberal, and so that is perhaps why there is this anti-development stance from some of their members. But yeah, I think they're kind of thought of in the mainstream as simply being right-wing, but there are some elements to their kind of mandate that complicates that. So what about with Vision? You guys, have you guys talked at all about, what's the fellow's name who's, the Squamish chief?
Ian Campbell.
Yeah, Ian Campbell. That's correct, right?
Yeah.
The Squamish Nation?
The hereditary chief of the Squamish Nation. Yeah. He seems to be sort of like the establishment favorite from within Vision, I guess.
Yeah.
There's also, Talib Noor Muhammad is running as well, a tech entrepreneur against him.
But, yes, you did mention that, yeah.
They're both, seeking the nomination. But Campbell, if he was elected, would be the first sort of indigenous leader of the city of Vancouver.
Yeah, and sorry, I know you guys did mention them. I was doing some tech stuff over here. But in regards to Ian Campbell, I know that there's been kind of conversations about the importance of him becoming the mayor because he is the indigenous hereditary chief of the Squamish Nation, indigenous to this area that Vancouver is on, these lands. And that importance trumping the actual party's politics. And I think that's kind of an interesting thing to talk about. What are your guys' thoughts on that? As non-Indigenous people, you might say.
as a white settler visiting
Yeah.
one thing that I found fascinating reading into this a little bit was that a few commentators were saying Campbell might be disadvantaged because he lives in North Vancouver, so he's not really from here, which which is a pretty amazing statement that the hereditary chief of the Squamish Nation is not really from here enough to be a real candidate. But I think so far as what the policies and the platform that he'd be sort of running on are concerned, it does seem to be actually pretty in keeping with Vision 101, the kind of the policies that they currently have and that they as a party will be running on this election as well. So as much as, it would be a pretty revolutionary thing to have an elected Indigenous leader here in Vancouver, Ian Campbell is still running as the Vision candidate.
Exactly.
His key issues are sort of, housing affordability, climate change, all the things that Gregor Robertson's been at least paying lip service to over the last 10 years, I guess. He also wants to, take action on job creation and homelessness and things like that. So it sounds like a pretty classically Vision platform. He's definitely still running like within that umbrella, I guess. Mm.
If he becomes mayor, the first Indigenous mayor, would this change vision, I guess shift vision towards more of a grassroots party? Because now that, because he's Indigenous, he will be more focused with, I guess, disenfranchised people or marginalized people. Obviously, mm-hmm. Vision itself has been talking about these issues, but do you think there'll be not a sudden, but at least a gradual change as he becomes mayor?
Well, I mean, I don't think you can expect someone to behave a certain way because they belong to a, you know, a demographic. So, but I think that's kind of the conversation that's interesting and being had, and not something we can sort of come to a grand conclusion on, but whether like the importance of having someone who is actually Indigenous to these lands that are, you know, colonially taken is more important than whatever his politics actually are, because these are technically the lands of the Squamish people and the Musqueam people. So I don't know, it's an interesting conversation.
I think for sure, like the question of I mean, not that it drives the policy of a candidate, but this question of like a new sort of candidate running in this race mm-hmm. is a, like mm-hmm. a recurring theme beyond Vision as well. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Vision's other candidate, so Noor Mohammed would be the first elected Muslim mayor if he was to get into office. And we have a few ladies potentially in the running to be the first female mayor in Vancouver's 130-something year history. Mm-hmm.
So many firsts to come.
So many firsts. One of whom, so Adrian Carr, who's the currently the Seoul Greens MP in local parliament, she, for the last few months, has sort of been ranking really highly in polls of a preferred new leader ahead of the election. Oh. And she had expressed her interest in running for the role were it to be appropriate and backed by her party and other parties. And one outcome of the whole Vision debacle, like them stepping back and then deciding that they will run their own candidate, is that it looks much less likely that she'll actually contest the election, because she was sort of looking for a combined progressive platform on the left and to stand for not just the Greens, but sort of a collective of Cope and Vision. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which doesn't appear to be what's happening in this election. So she may not actually end up running despite being one of the preferred candidates.
So you're saying she might not run because she doesn't want to further divide the left?
Yeah, and I think she would probably seek re-election as a councillor, mm-hmm. but would not try to run for mayor if it looks like she wouldn't really be supported beyond the Green Party.
So on the left, what groups are splitting the vote?
Well, it's mainly independents, I think. So Vision will definitely be running a candidate. We don't know who yet. Mm-hmm. One city haven't announced either. There was sort of this talk about them, all of the sort of like Team Jean and Cope and One City and all like trying to decide how many councillors, how many school board trustees, how many park board trustees, and who they would run for mayor. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't happen, it may be the case that One City also announce their own candidate. But at the moment, it's less that the political parties have started announcing a lot of candidates and more that several independents who might not have run had they not thought they could get Vision support have announced. So that's, Shauna Sylvester, who I mentioned earlier, but also Ken Stewart, who is a sitting MP in Burnaby. And he was one of the people who got arrested at the Kinder Morgan gates alongside Elizabeth May a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
So he's become a really prominent figure for his opposition to the pipeline out in Burnaby. And he also announced that he would run for mayor before he knew that he wouldn't have Vision's backing.
Right.
So I think it's more that there's quite a few independents who may not have actually run had they known there was no chance of getting united support from the left.
Oh, but it feels like independent candidates have more of a chance now because of the new policy about funding the elections and like the new, I guess, limits on how much you have.
So now you can no longer make political donations above like what? $200?
$1,200. Yeah, but that's a significant cap when you're looking at sort of like a major real estate developer.
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah. But for some reason, I thought it was like 200, so that's a jump to me. But, okay, so yeah, there's that. So that's what's been commented on a lot.
Right, right.
So how does that cap on political donations kind of strengthen the left or their chances? Is it because they don't get as many donations and so we're kind of capping the right?
Well, I think there'd been a lot of like hopeful rhetoric around this meeting that maybe non-establishment candidates would have a bit more of a fair run of things.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, one thing we're seeing with like Bremner breaking away from the NPA is that he is, the darling of the real estate industry, will mm-hmm. easily be able to garner a huge amount of financial support. He's also probably going to take a lot of NPA backers with him as well. And so it's not really the case, I think, that this will mean new people are being supported. Certainly Bremner would pull sort of a lot of weight as well. So it's not really like the little guys coming up so much as the right splitting in half.
Yeah.
And the NPA have also said that they're not going to stick to, so there's a little loophole with the funding laws that means that you individual sort of parties are still able to accept donations greater than this amount if they go towards the running of that party.
Right.
So Vision, for example, actually spend more than $1 million a year on office staff and campaigns and stuff, which is technically not a donation, but goes towards running the party. And they've said that doing that, Vision have said that accepting that money is like outside the spirit of this law. So they're not going to be accepting it. But the NPA have said we will continue to accept those funds. So how effective that rule will be, I guess, remains to be seen. The NPA certainly still say they're very happy to take money beyond that.
Yeah.
And Bremner appears to have, a lot of cash in hand as well.
Well, okay, I feel like we should maybe conclude this.
People should know, though. One thing people should know is that elections do not close, the candidacy doesn't close until September. So you can actually nominate to be the mayor of
That's
Vancouver.
What I was going to ask you for, are like if you could go over the key dates coming up.
Yeah.
One of
well,
you.
So yeah, the official nominations with the city aren't until September. But individual, so the key parties will, I guess, be locking in their candidates before that.
Yeah, it ends at September 14th, to be exact.
Yeah, so if you want to get your nomination in, do it before September 14th. I believe the NPA will be finalizing their nominee on June 3rd. I don't know if Vision have a definite date yet for theirs, but they said that they'll be finalizing theirs in June as well.
Mm. And the election's on October 20th?
Yeah.
Yep. And announcement, elected officials will be sworn in on November 5th, to be exact.
Mark your diaries.
You heard it here first. Okay, thanks, Zoe and Ruben. We're now going to play a couple PSAs. Right now, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just had a discussion on the coming municipal election. And after our break, we're going to be hearing a report from City Hall that took place last Wednesday on the recent ban on single-use plastic items. Please stay tuned.
Do you have more drawings than fit on your parents' fridge? In lectures, does note-taking sometimes distract you from your doodling? We know how you feel. VASA, the Visual Arts Students Association, is here for you. You can submit your masterpiece for our upcoming show, attend a talk, behind-the-scenes museum tour, or workshop about developing your professional practice, or even just come hang out. Check out our events on facebook.com/vasa.ubc or even our Instagram and Twitter, and join in for our weekly drawing challenge.
Hey, what's wrong?
I've been looking for a job since I came to Canada, and I haven't found anything.
Have you tried WorkLearn?
What's WorkLearn?
Part-time jobs on campus for international undergraduate students just like us help me find a great job that's actually related to my studies.
Wow! I'll have to check that out.
You should. It's good pay, good experience, and good for your career. Just look for WorkLearn postings at www.careersonline.ubc.ca. You can even ask your profs and campus staff if they can create a job for you.
To participate in WorkLearn, you must be an international student seeking an undergraduate degree in a participating faculty and registered full-time with a study permit valid for at least 6 months. For more information, visit www.careers.ubc.ca.
On Wednesday, May 16th, the City of Vancouver voted to go forward on a proposal to reduce waste caused by single-use items. This ban is part of the city's larger strategy to achieve zero waste by 2040. The ban on single-use items prohibits the use of polystyrene foam containers and cups, plastic straws, and requires customers to ask for plastic utensils. Democracy Watch was at City Hall reporting.
The rationale is that under the current recycling scheme offered by Recycle BC, these cups and containers can't be collected in the curbside, multifamily, or streetscape recycling programs. And as a result, foam is littered and potentially ends up in the marine environment, or it's disposed to the garbage and goes to landfill or incinerator.
This is Andrea Reimer, a city councillor representing the Vision Party and Council.
Actually, because of completeness, we heard that it didn't make sense to only target cups without targeting straws, and they're also part of this culture of disposability. Straws are not recyclable, and they're prevalent in litter.
While City Council voted in favor of this ban, there was ample opposition. Strong criticism was voiced from Vice President of Sustainability of the Canadian Plastics Industry Association, Joe Hruska. He claims the production of paper alternatives will produce more greenhouse gases than the current production of plastics for single-use items.
There's a number of things. We know the Polera poll showed people did not want to support the ban. It dropped from 69 to 26% support when they found out it was recyclable. So people want to do the right thing, and that is recycle. Mm. One of the things we found out in that poll, they want a greater access to recycling, and they're thirsty for more information, and I think the poll shows that.
The Polera poll cited by Hruska was commissioned by the Canadian Plastics Industry Association. Another concern about the ban came from project manager Dunya Saime of the nonprofit organization Downtown Eastside Kitchen Tables. While Saime was in favor of the proposal, she spoke about the added costs it will place on her charitable organization, which provides healthy meals for low-income residents in the Downtown Eastside.
So, from what I've heard from the chefs in the Downtown Eastside who prepare together, I would say 6,000 meals a day. They're on like less than $2 budgets, and so the main concern was affordability and suggesting things that city and council could take on in order to subsidize or to support us in phasing into the ban. So our position, I would say, is to endorse the reduction strategy. It's just with a big like, but we need support. Yeah.
According to a statistic in the city's single-use item reduction strategy, 86% of Vancouverites favor a ban on the single-use plastic items. With National Geographic's June 2018 cover story highlighting the impact of single-use plastics on our oceans and increasing mainstream coverage of the same issue, public opinion on the dangers of plastic consumption seems to be growing.
Thinking about reducing single-use items in Vancouver, and then how could that affect the marine environment, which encompasses the whole globe, we're just a small piece. And as I said earlier, I think Vancouver is well situated to be a global leader and to show that reducing single-use plastics is possible. And by reducing single-use plastics that are seen as cheap and that you just throw away, which ultimately, if improperly disposed of, end up in waterways, that can have a definitely a cumulative effect over time to reducing plastic pollution entering into the marine environment.
Two local high school students, Charlotte Brady and Anastasia Castro, also share their concern.
The fact is that plastic bags are really harmful, mostly just because they do not decompose. It is impossible for them to do that. And plastic bags, they still haven't decomposed. So the first plastic bag that was created in 1950 is still around out there and will probably be out there for the next 500 years. And these are plastic bags, thin plastic bags. Other more sturdy plastics could be around for the next thousands of years.
So what we've seen for what kind of reasonable options we want, looking at, say, you go into a grocery store and you need a small, thin plastic bag to hold, say, fruits or vegetables. Well, in that case, we'd be looking at more mesh bags that are easy to hold specific fruits or vegetables, individual items. For carrying large items out of a grocery store, you could look at heavier tote bags, like reusable bags. And as my partner said, even though they do have more of an environmental impact being made in the moment, we're really looking at cost effectiveness and how long it takes for these bags to decompose and how long you can really use them after the fact.
These alarming facts were also substantiated by much of the business community, including the Retail Council of Canada. Greg Wilson, Director of Government Relations, discusses the importance of environmental ethics in business development.
I think the entire retail sector is a big supporter because in the end, we recognize that the plastic we put into the environment is having an impact. So we're looking at ways to responsibly reduce that amount of plastic. There are a lot of regulatory problems here. I mean, complications such as food health and food safety, consumer product safety and what have you. Some of the packaging is required by other levels of government, particularly the federal government. And so you have to reduce responsibly. So a lot of these single-use packaging that the City of Vancouver is talking about, this is packaging that's not necessarily as necessary as some of the things that are protecting consumer product safety or food safety.
Although this ban on single-use items passed in council on May 16th, the city's Department of Waste Management and Resource Recovery will continue taking feedback and considering potential exemptions to the ban. They will issue a report with recommendations on December 31st. A question that remains largely unanswered is if the city's response matches the urgency of the environmental situation.
All right. Hello. That was a report put together on Democracy Watch by our comrades Sammy Smart and Aiden Tong. Awesome. That was the first time I was hearing it. Excellent. Excellent reporting on City Hall. So we just wanted to follow up that pre-produced piece with a bit of a discussion with the reporters involved in both reporting and producing it. Anything that was left out of the report that you guys wanted to mention from your experience being at City Hall and talking with all these people?
Yeah, actually, you know, the Joe Haresco, Vice President mm-hmm. Sustainability with Plastics Canada, he was a very, he was a very cordial guy, very nice, and he did have a few valid points. I mean, what's interesting about him is that he's the creator of the blue box that we have here.
Sorry, can you say what that is?
The blue box in Canada.
Oh, so the recycling box. Okay.
Yeah. But just a few points, which I thought was interesting. Like, he said that to go green would create more expenditure for local Vancouverites.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a very expensive housing city, so he thought that would also be a problem. But I mean, Councillor Reimer. She actually opposed that view and said 78% of Vancouverites were ready to pay more money to go green, as well as he noted that a lot of the microplastics that originate from plastic not being able to decompose, a lot of the microplastics that were found in our ocean were coming from Southeast Asia, but the ocean conservationist Julie that we interviewed,
mm-hmm.
She did agree to an extent with that point, but it's a global issue. Mm-hmm. Microplastics in the ocean is a very big problem.
Yeah.
So she was saying to point fingers at different people and organizations and countries like will not help alleviate this problem, and mm-hmm. I found that perspective is a perspective that everyone should be taking into account.
Right. But then at the same time, don't you think what other countries are doing is a good point of reference? And maybe we can talk about some examples of plastic bans that are happening in other places?
So there is a ban that was enacted in Kenya.
Right.
And I'm just looking at the article here.
Yeah.
It's like the world's toughest ban on plastic bags, and there's mm-hmm. like a maximum sentence of 4 years imprisonment or a fine of $40,000 for anyone producing, selling, or even carrying a plastic bag.
Right. And when was this ban?
It came in on August 28th, 2017.
Okay, yeah. So less than a year ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've read about that too. it's pretty intense. And yeah, so some of the criticisms were similar to like the arguments being made at City Hall that, you know, people with less money obviously prefer to use plastic bags because they're cheap rather than the more environmental alternatives. As well, it's an inconvenience for a lot of people. So in this one article that I think from The Guardian, it's probably the one you're reading too, they, you know, talk about how this is an issue. But I don't know, I guess it comes back to the way you guys ended the piece, which was that, you know, we kind of need to contemplate the urgency of the issue. And so is it worth hurting certain parties, which of course end up being more marginalized people, in order to do to achieve this greater good? I don't know.
Well, you know what I found interesting as well is the woman Dunya that we interviewed. She was obviously from the nonprofit organization, the Kitchen Tables, and she was handing out the meals to them. But they were trying to find an alternative container that would be the same price as what they were using. But fundamentally, she said that she was still supportive of this ban because I think she recognized the significance of the issue. And I mean, that ties in with a lot what these young high school students were advocating for, is the fact that these plastic bags take sometimes 1,000 years to decompose. And again, like the microplastics in the ocean is extremely harmful.
Yeah.
I think like a big thing that needs to be considered is like buyback programs and like subsidies to make sure that those nonprofit organizations can afford to use alternatives. And so like, I guess that's up to the city and like up to people who speak up for it. And it's not only people who are in like a bad financial situation. It's also an important issue for people with disabilities where they might need a straw to consume a drink. And the alternatives aren't always affordable or useful. Sometimes they need the flexibility that a plastic straw has. And metal straws can be potentially dangerous for some people with musculoskeletal diseases. And they're not like friendly for most people's budgets.
Yeah.
And they're not very accessible at this point. So there needs to be like a lot of thought put into that at this point.
Right. And you know what? So, I mean, my perspective generally tends to be like the greater good is more important. This is so urgent. The world is becoming toxic. However, it seems that the core of this issue is really the culture we live in and our societal perspective, the sort of right to convenience. So if we're banning single-use plastic items and saying like, oh, well, it's too bad you have a disability or you can't afford to do this, it's for the greater good. But what else are we changing in society? Like all the things, you know, we do are also part of this culture of convenience. So, you know, we can only do that, I think, if we're doing that in all the other sectors, right? Like if we can no longer buy clothes that have, you know, are made of plastic, synthetic plastic fabrics, or, you know, we no longer rely much, much less on fossil fuels. Like, you know, we kind of, it's like the whole world, at least the Western world mentality of a culture of convenience needs to shift. We can't just be like, okay, we're going to get rid of plastic bags. Like, yeah, that's super important. And the evidence shows the environmental hazard that comes with plastic never biodegrading, but it's other things too. And also, you know, we won't get into, but the issue that, you know, we're talking about single-use plastic items, but plastic is in everything. So this isn't, we're not even talking about really plastic. We're just talking about like a small amount of plastic. So yeah, things are looking bright for the world. We need to actually move on because we have another piece and we're running out of time. Did you guys have any last words? I'll just leave it with my philosophical tirade. Cool. So that was a piece on last Wednesday's City Hall hearing on the ban of single-use plastic items put together by Sammy Smart and Aiden Tong. We're now going to turn to a report that I did today, which is essentially a series of interviews on a pipeline that's being built through Richmond to supply jet fuel directly to the airport. I'll just let you hear the report. Here we go.
John Horgan's NDP government here in BC. Hi there, I'm Alex DeBoer, a reporter with Democracy Watch. So a couple of days ago, I was riding the bus to work and reading the newspaper, reading about the ongoing drama between Rachel Notley's NDP government in Alberta and Premier John Horgan's NDP government here in BC. As the battle over the twinning of Kinder Morgan's pipeline continues, with Notley's refusal to attend the recent Western Province and Territory Leaders Conference, as well as Alberta's passing of Bill 12, which, if you don't know, gives Alberta the power to regulate the flow of refined petroleum from Alberta into BC, which is obviously a major problem for BC. So I was reading about this, and I didn't find any of these retaliations on Alberta's part particularly shocking. But what I did find myself scratching my head at was a comment that Rachel Notley made, where she said that BC is quietly and happily building a pipeline under protected wetland in the Lower Mainland, particularly Richmond, in order to facilitate importing jet fuel from Korea. And at the same time, the BC NDP are combating Alberta's attempts at moving oil product to the West Coast. And she was bringing this up to highlight the irony. So this was news to me, which is perhaps embarrassing. But after learning this, I did a little reading and found out that there is, in fact, a pipeline being built through Richmond. So what you're about to hear is an interview with Glenn Korstrom, a reporter with Business in Vancouver, BIV.com, if you want to check it out. So Glenn wrote an article for Business in Vancouver, which also appeared in the Richmond News. In that article, he wrote about the City of Richmond's pending approval of a permit for a YVR jet fuel pipeline set to run through the Lower Mainland. In 2013, the provincial government, which was then the Liberals, granted a conditional environmental assessment approval for a jet fuel pipeline to Vancouver International Airport. This proposed pipeline would run from the south arm of the Fraser River across the city of Richmond to the airport on Sea Island. The finished project is set to include a marine terminal on the Fraser, 15 kilometers of pipeline, and a tank farm with 6 tanks currently under construction with a capacity of 80 million liters. The idea behind this pipeline, from my understanding, is to make YVR's fuel supply less precarious. Right now, they rely on the existing Kinder Morgan pipeline, which transports fuel, oil from Alberta, and I believe they only have about a week supply if that pipeline gets turned off. So this pipeline, which spans a much smaller geographical distance and is direct to the airport and would have these tank farms with large holding tanks, as I mentioned, holding 80 million liters of fuel, it would make the airport fuel supply much safer and more secure. So that's the idea behind that. I started out my interview with Glenn by asking if, in fact, this jet fuel pipeline had been under construction since 2013 when the Liberal government gave it conditional environmental approval. Let's take a listen.
Last year, there was some site clearing on the south arm of the Fraser on Portland to build the marine terminal, and Richmond in the next few months is set to approve, because a city committee recommended they approve, and the spokesperson there said that they have to approve a development permit. It's just a matter of a formality for the route of the pipeline. So the actual pipeline still needs Richmond's development permit, as well as a separate bilateral agreement between the pipeline financiers and the city.
Right, yeah. I read that, obviously, as well, that the city essentially has to approve the permit. Could you elaborate a bit more on that, why their hand is being forced?
Because it's not municipal jurisdiction to approve a pipeline. It's federal and provincial, which the pipeline already has approval federally and provincially, so it's kind of like the jurisdictional battle that John Horgan is playing out, and believing that the province might have some ability to stop Kinder Morgan, but Trudeau is quite clear it's federal authority, and the National Energy Board has given this pipeline in Richmond the okay.
Right, and so how this is different than what's happening with Kinder Morgan, though, is that the NDP is demanding that there is a more in-depth environmental assessment being done. So could the provincial government also demand that in the case of this pipeline?
I think it's too late, and the province already provided the approval.
Yeah, back in 2013.
It would be before Horgan. I'm not sure whether he would want to wade in, and or even legally whether he could. But I mean, some would say that he's not legally following what he should be able to do with the Kinder Morgan pipeline.
Indeed. Yeah, I tried to call the minister, the environmental minister today, actually, to get comment. So perhaps I will hear back from him on the provincial government's thoughts on whether this is ironic, as sort of Rachel Notley has been pointing out in the news. The previous environmental minister with the Liberals said that this pipeline method is safer for the public and there's less risk to the environment. I was wondering, in your reporting, did you delve at all into the environmental risks of this pipeline?
The current system is such that it is estimated to be 45 trucks or so every day coming up from Washington State, burning fuel, obviously, all the way. So there's clearly an environmental impact of the current system, where there is a pipeline already, that would fall into disuse if this new pipeline gets built. So, I mean, essentially you're replacing it's a 49-year-old pipeline, a spike line from the Burnaby Kinder Morgan facility. Mm-hmm. And if that goes into disuse, then that's one less pipeline. So here we just have a new pipeline, so you'll have better, I would imagine, better construction, better safety for the new pipeline than the current pipeline. So arguably the new pipeline is a much safer and much more sustainable alternative.
Right, and the land itself in Richmond, which is below sea level and all that, did anyone comment on like the particular geography of the area being bad for the pipeline, more so than, you know, other areas?
I'm not sure if anyone made that objection. Okay. I wasn't following the hearings very closely, but I'm not sure if the elevation of the land is how relevant that is.
Yeah. Okay. So then basically what we can anticipate is that the project development permit will probably be granted in a couple months by the City of Richmond?
It could be. In the next few months, that's what I've heard. And there was actually a Vancouver International Airport, their organizing body, the Vancouver Airport Authority's CEO, spoke at a public meeting earlier this month and was saying that he thought the Richmond meeting would be in June.
Okay.
So it's, this pipeline project has been going on for over a decade, and there's delays every step of the way, so I wouldn't be surprised if things get delayed.
Indeed, yeah. And so is there anything you could foresee happening in council that would prevent this permit from being granted?
No, because the spokesperson, Ted Townsend, mm-hmm. who knows what's going on in Richmond, he's been there for a long time, and he was quite clear that they don't have a choice. They can't say no to the pipeline. And theoretically, and I think this happened in Burnaby with Kinder Morgan, the National Energy Board, when the city of Burnaby was trying to say, well, we're not going to give you a permit, the National Energy Board said, well, disregard them. They don't have jurisdiction.
Right.
So basically, Richmond either grants this permit or they could be told that they aren't needed.
Right, yeah. Do you see this pipeline, and this is maybe just your personal opinion I'm asking for here, as becoming another kind of hot topic controversy with a lot of resistance, like Kinder Morgan?
I think it, objectively it already has. There is a lot of interest I've noticed on the Business in Vancouver website, mm-hmm. Where my story appeared. There's lots of traction for it, and Business in Vancouver has been ahead of the curve on this, had a really big article last June by my colleague Nelson Bennett, who covers resources, that really probed into the fact that work had clearing of the Port of Vancouver land had been going on, and the city of Richmond wasn't able to stop that because it's not Richmond land.
Yeah, what can you explain who has jurisdiction over that land?
Well, the Port Authority itself is able to determine what happens on its land. There might be some federal input, but there's no civic or provincial ability to stop the port from doing things on land.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Great. Okay. Have a nice day. After talking with Glenn, I was still confused about why a city committee would recommend to approve the permits for this pipeline, as I know Richmond Mayor Malcolm Brody, as well as some Richmond City councillors such as Carol Day, oppose the pipeline. I was also curious, who are the city committee? Who are they made up of? So I called media rep Ted Townsend from the City of Richmond. He's the Director of Corporate Communications and Marketing, and he spoke to me. He told me that the city committee is made up of senior city staff, such as general managers. He said that because the pipeline is a federal project and because it has already been approved by the former provincial government, the city can't actually reject the pipeline. They can only reject the permits, and only with reason. So the permits the City of Richmond needs to approve in order to make this pipeline happen are technical in nature. They relate to the design of the fuel holding facility and the environmental precautions being taken to prevent spills, things like that, logistical and technical things. So I asked City Representative Ted Townsend if, since the mayor and Carol Day are against the pipeline, if this means that the city committee's recommendations to approve the pipeline permits, that is, mean that the committee has a more conservative political stance. Ted said that that would not be accurate to say. So I then decided to try and speak with the mayor or Carol Day, city councilor. I was lucky enough to catch Carol on her cell phone before a meeting. I asked her for her thoughts on why this city committee, made up of city staff members, were in favor of passing the pipeline permits.
As a councillor and a community activist, and the only person in the council that has actually sued the provincial government about this jet fuel project, I can say that I would do everything in my power to stop the jet fuel project from moving forward. Having said that, we have legal requirements. In other words, if the VAFMC fulfill all of the criteria put down by the BC Environmental Assessment Office, the BCAO, then we're stuck. And so that's where basically staff comes in, that they have to work within the system. They can't be militant like counselors can.
Yeah, totally. So when they made the recommendation that counselors approve of these permits, are they just doing this because they think it's sort of futile to resist?
It could be, yeah, it's quite likely. I still would like to, you know, I'll read the report when it comes through and talk to my fellow community activists to find out what we can do. I mean, if there is some way that we can stall or not approve the project, I'm all over that, because it is an absolutely terrible, terrible project. I mean, can you imagine having an 80 million jet fuel tank farm a stone's throw from condos, an entertainment area, including a swimming pool, a bowling alley, and an industrial area? It just doesn't make any sense.
I'm wondering what you think of the amount of attention this pipeline has received compared with the Kinder Morgan pipeline.
You know, ironically, it isn't the pipeline that's the problem. If the pipeline ran from YVR to the Cherry Point Refinery in Washington State, we wouldn't have a problem with it. That even the old council before the new election would have supported it. And the reason being that the entire issue here is not the pipeline. It's more that we're going to have an 80-million-liter jet fuel tank farm on the bank of the Fraser River, the most important sand run in the world.
Right. So what hope do you have of stalling or preventing this pipeline from going through?
The previous government, the conservative government, had the Port of Vancouver be the federal entity. They're the ones deciding what to do on this whole project. And what's really scary about that is they're not just the ones approving, they're also the landlord. So major conflict of interest, because they're the ones hosting the 80 million liter jet fuel tank farm. So, you know, you've got a situation where, you know, the fox is guarding the hen house, right?
Right.
And so in the end, it's really, it's volatile. And so I don't know what the city can do. I guess it's difficult to get rid of a project that's already been approved, especially at a federal level.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, from my perspective, anything that we can do to just draw attention to it could end up resulting in a better project. For example, the Richmond firefighters are very concerned about how they can put out a fire at a jet fuel terminal.
Right.
The reality is they can't. So during this process, if all we do is stall the process and draw attention to it, it could be we bring in better standards and better safety mechanisms for the project. And if that's all we accomplish, that's still pretty significant.
And so with the port, so the federal government owns the port itself? They have jurisdiction?
Okay. No, the federal government is the Port of Vancouver is underneath the federal government, and the Port of Vancouver is the governing agent in this project, which is insane.
Right.
But that was the way the feds prior to Libs set that up.
Yes.
Now, the land that the marine terminal is on is owned by the VAFFC, which is the Vancouver Airport Fuel Facilities Corporation, a nonprofit company that supplies fuel to the airlines. Now, the land that the 80 million liter jet fuel tank farm sits on, which is six-story tall tanks, is owned by the Port of Vancouver,
right,
which is under the jurisdiction of the federal government. Well, they approve the project, then they are the landlord to the project. And so Richmond's stuck in the middle between the BC Environmental Assessment Office, which under the Liberal government approved this project,